coming up on Inside the U.S. Open.
I mean, I think it all begins with having a system that gives players opportunities, that provides coaches with education, parents with education.
I think that's the biggest thing is as you start watching it, you'll just realize that it's just tennis, you know, and you'll see that we're doing the same things as the able-bodied world is and giving it our best effort out there.
I think for me, the best part is just the travel, being in different places, experiencing tennis in different ways. You know, all four Grand Slams have a completely different atmosphere, a different feel to them. And it makes it, like I've said before, different every day I go to work.
Hey everyone, it's Nick McCarville and it's episode 6 of Inside the U.S. Open. Now we're into the second week of the Open and things slowed down on the singles front, but that leaves room for some other events part of the U.S. Open. We've got the wheelchair event, juniors, doubles, mixed doubles, lots going on around the grounds. Now we talked to a few of the characters that are involved in said events, and first we talked to Martin Blackman, the general manager of USTA Player Development. He talks to us about the junior success for Americans and also what's gone well for the Americans in the main draw. Then we get a chance to talk with David Wagner. He's a Paralympic gold medalist wheelchair tennis player, and he's also a multi-time champion right here at the U.S. Open. Lastly, we talk to a face that many of you tennis fans are going to be familiar with. His name's Jake Garner. He's from Tallahassee, Florida. He's been to 5 U.S. Open finals as a chair umpire. We get his insight into the chair umpire world. He's got the best seat in the house, and we talk to him about that job. First, let's chat with Martin Blackman. All right, Martin Blackman, who's general manager of the player development program. Now, we know that week one is all about the main draw, but week two, we get these other events, right? Including the juniors, and the American junior girls especially have had a great year. But tell us a little bit about the junior program, where you see it, not only at the elite level, but kind of as you have done with the grassroots and with developing these players to get to the, you know, to get to the international stage where they are.
Sure. So, I mean, it's very exciting here. Second week, like you said, we have 20 girls in the main draw out of 64. And we have 5 girls who could have played. Players like Cece Bellis and Kayla Day. So we're in a really good place there. And I think it all begins with having a system that gives players opportunities. That provides coaches with education, parents with education. And I think the key factor to our current success has been the strength of our Team USA initiative, which is a really concerted effort to strengthen our relationships with the coaches that really do the hard work in the field day in and day out, and really make sure that we're respecting the role of that primary developmental coach so that when the time comes for us to play a more active role in the development of these players, it's a very mutual decision that's made organically, where the private coach in many cases is reaching out to us and asking us to help them. So I think that's been huge, and I think we have to continue doing business that way, letting players develop locally close to home for as long as possible, being very flexible in the way we offer support and recognizing the importance of the private sector coach. And, you know, here at this level, this is, as you said, the elite level of the juniors. It starts to become a very expensive and comprehensive proposition to really get these players what they need to either transition onto the tour or into high-level college tennis.
Yeah, and for you, can you explain that a little bit more? Because I think we see the players at the U.S. Open, and it's hard to know each of their individual stories, but the coaching system, how you guys have continued to try to work with, as you're saying, local coaches, because for a while it was all about sending your kid to an academy if they were great at tennis. Sure. But that's not necessarily the system, I think, that you at least are trying to run at this point.
Sure. I mean, look, there are a lot of great academies out there, and that's still a viable option if that's what parents and families think, but our philosophy as a federation is that we really want to facilitate the development of those young players at home for as long as possible. Because one of the things that we've learned is, you know, the character piece, the social piece, the educational piece, having some balance, those are kind of foundational qualities that are going to serve the player well as they transition onto a more international tour and have to be more independent and have to make really tough decisions away from their family. So that's been our philosophy. I think it's working really well. We don't do any year-round boarding at our centers in Orlando or Carson. Players can come in and train for as little as 3 days or as much as 3 weeks. And then gradually they transition into our program if that's what their parents and coaches want.
Now, we've had some great American names in this tournament. Whitney Asigwe, Anne Lee, Claire Liu, Patrick Kipson played the main draw in the men's event. And actually, we had an all-girls final at Wimbledon, right? And did we have one, an all-American girls final, that is? And do we have one at the French Open, too?
Not at the French. Whitney won. Yeah, at Wimbledon, we did. Claire beat Anne Lee in the finals there. That was really exciting. But like you said, I mean, we've got 8 to 10 girls who are really doing well, not just in the juniors, but also in small pro events as well. So the pipeline is really full. They're all different. They all have individual needs. They all have different game styles. But we feel like the group of girls that we have right now are girls that you could be seeing here on Arthur Ashe Stadium in 3 to 4 years.
Well, as you mentioned, it's been an incredible, incredible Grand Slam for the American women. I mean, first time since 1981 that we saw four American women into the semifinals, which is, it's just crazy to look at it and the way that it all developed. Venus, Coco Sloan, and Madison Keys doing what they did. I mean, that to you, obviously, you said before we started recording, it's all credit to them and their teams. But it's a great moment for American tennis overall, too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great moment. I mean, you know, Our philosophy is to play a supporting role and to really make sure that the players know that we're here for them to give them whatever performance team support they need. In some cases, we are supplemental, and in some cases, we do direct coaching. But, you know, when you look at the four women that are in the semifinals, they're all very unique, but the commonality is that they have great teams around them. And I really, you know, I just really admire the work that they've put in to continue to overcome some things, in some cases injuries, in some cases maybe years where they didn't perform like they thought they should, but they're all living up to their potential. Really, I'm talking about the three younger women.
Yeah, sure.
Venus has always, she has always lived up to her potential. Yeah, so I'm talking about the three younger women, you know, and to be on the same stage at your home slam. The ripple effect for American tennis is going to carry on for many years to come.
So we're talking a little bit with Martin Blackman about the junior development, obviously, and working with those local coaches or private coaches. But then also we've seen the young American men. We saw Francis Tiafoe take Roger Federer to 5 sets. Taylor Fritz won a round. Jared Donaldson's had an incredible year. Ernesto Escobedo. You've got a lot of these guys who are coming up. How then are you trying to work with those guys to make sure that we've got that next wave of young Americans coming through on the men's side?
Absolutely. Great question. Well, you know, I think it starts with one of the things I should have mentioned before is in terms of our system and our training and what happens at our centers, I think it all started with Jose Higueras coming on board and bringing a really unified coaching philosophy that not just unified our national coaching staff, but also coaches around the country. And I think what we're seeing now is the first class of players that have come through private sector camps and kind of matriculated onto the tour. And now with Brian Bolin, our new head of men's tennis, coming on board, we have a focus and a sense of urgency to make sure that we're providing the young men that you just mentioned with everything that they need to break into the top 50, top 20, and top 10.
Now, I've been out on court on Grandstand this tournament announcing, and each morning we've had young kids from the NetGen program, which is the developmental program for young kids. They're playing with bigger balls, softer balls, smaller rackets, smaller nets, but basically it's the USTA's hope and want to grow the game in that way and let the sport be more accessible, I think, for younger kids at a younger age to then graduate to a US Open regulation size court.
Sure, sure. I mean, that is one of the most exciting initiatives I think that we've ever launched. You know, when we take a step back and player development looks at, you know, what do we need to have long-term sustained success? And we need a lot of kids coming into the game. You know, we need kids from diverse backgrounds, diverse communities, great athletes. We need them coming into the game. And I think we need, in many ways, we need to reposition tennis as a game that's really attractive to millennial families. And that's what NetGen does. It's a great value proposition for a family that's about to choose a sport and really positions tennis to be delivered the right way. As you said, in the right format, the 10 and under formats, which are red, orange, and green, the right duration, and the right type of programming, which is fun, dynamic, gives the kids the foundational skills, but also stresses character development as well. So NetGen is going to be a game changer for tennis in America.
All right. Well, thank you, Martin, so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks to Martin Blackman for giving us insight on all things American tennis. Now let's switch gears and talk to David Wagner. I told you at the beginning of the episode that he's one of the best wheelchair tennis players in the world, but I asked him first off to explain the different divisions that are included in wheelchair tennis.
In wheelchair tennis, there's a men's division, a women's division, and then what we have called a quadriplegic division, and it's for individuals who have an upper body impairment as well as a lower body impairment. So for myself, as a quadriplegic, my hands are paralyzed, and I have to tape the racket to my hand, so I can't switch my grip, I can't change my grip. I'm stuck in one grip for the entire practice, match, whatever it is I'm playing or doing. And that's the main difference being we still use the same chair, same court, same everything else is the same, except we use some sort of disability in our upper body, some less than others, but enough to class into our division where you do have an upper body disability. So,
and then for people who haven't watched wheelchair tennis before, and in any sense, the biggest difference, obviously, that I've noticed is the two bounces. But what else would people notice that might be different?
Sure. Well, inside of wheelchair tennis, there's only one rule change. And the only rule change outside of, you know, you have to use a wheelchair, obviously. But the only rule change is that we are allowed two bounces if we need it. The first bounce has to be within the regulation court of singles or doubles. And the second bounce can be anywhere. It can't bounce off your body, your chair, or the fence, but it can bounce outside the confines of singles or doubles lines. But I would say 90% of the time, players are taking it on one bounce or volleying it. So you don't have to let it bounce twice. You don't have to take it after the second bounce. So, but that's the only rule change. Everything else is the same. We play on the same court, same net, same height, same officials, same ball, same rackets. I mean, nothing else changes. And that's actually what makes wheelchair tennis so awesome, because it integrates so well. It's something that I can go do with an able-bodied person. I don't need to have somebody sitting in a chair to hit balls with me. So I can play with someone in a chair, or I can play with someone standing. And that makes it such a great sport.
Well, and for tennis fans who haven't seen wheelchair tennis before, it's amazing to watch, I think, because there's that added aspect of the second bounce, add some angles and what you guys can do differently in the court. And for me, I mean, obviously, you know, initially I took to tennis and know the sport very well, but it in essence can be a different sport, even though it feels much the same as well.
I mean, to me, it's not a whole lot different. I played some collegiate level tennis before I got hurt. And, you know, realistically, the only difference being that second bounce gives you time that sometimes you can hold, and your opponent has to decide to go one way or the other, and then you can hit the ball. And that's really all that second bounce really gives you is that opportunity. Or if they hit a drop shot, you can go run down a drop shot. And then if they lob over you, you can go run down the lob with two bounces. But if you come out and you watch it, you'll see most guys are most guys and girls, and most players in wheelchair tennis are just taking the ball early and on one bounce and just playing one bounce tennis majority of the time. Second bounce just buys us a little bit of time on a short shot or an angled shot, because in tennis, in wheelchair tennis, we have no lateral movement to the baseline. So everything we do is in recovery mode at angles away from the net. So we hit a forehand and we turn our back on our opponent and push back towards the back fence at an angle that allows us to maneuver our chair in a better way, because we have that no lateral sidestep movement. So
you mentioned that you played collegiate tennis. Can you give people just a little bit of your backstory and how you ended up being an elite wheelchair tennis player?
Yeah, sure. Well, so I played college tennis in Walla Walla, Washington, where I grew up. And when I played over the course of my first year of college, and my freshman year in the summer, I had an accident where I went down to the beach in Redondo, California, and with a buddy of mine and visiting some family and friends down there. And we had been in the surf all day, and I got tossed around by a wave. And when I got tossed, I landed wrong on my neck, and that ended up snapping my neck and paralyzing me from the mid-chest level down as a result, as a quadriplegic, and paralyzed my hands, hence the reason I taped the racket to my hand. And so for me, I knew tennis before, and I was able to kind of learn wheelchair tennis, which isn't a whole lot different from the able body game, just how to maneuver the chair and get around from point A to point B. So it was just a natural fit for me, and I loved the sport before I got hurt, and so just fell in love with it again after I got hurt.
And obviously you've been playing in Walla Walla, but did it take you a while to get back into the sport after the injury?
Yeah, I got hurt in 95, and in 99 I found wheelchair tennis. And I was really fortunate to learn from, at the time, world number one Randy Snow in the men's division, world number one Rick Draney in the quad division, and kind of the founder or the starter of wheelchair tennis with the USTA, Dan James, as the head coach. I was able to learn from those three guys, and you're talking of U.S. wheelchair tennis, you're talking like the best of the best in the history of U.S. And so I learned right off the bat from three of the best people in wheelchair tennis to learn from. So I was really fortunate from that aspect. So
now you've been here before, obviously, a seven-time doubles champ. You've won singles a couple times. You've been to how many Paralympics? Three, four?
I've been to four. My first games were in Athens, and then 4 years later, Beijing. 4 years after that, London, and then just most recent 2016, Rio. So
we're here at the U.S. Open. I think people can probably hear some of the noise around us. We're in the player lounge. But for you guys, when you're getting ready for a big event, just walk me through a little bit of the detail that you have to do, the preparation to get ready for these bigger events.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we take it just as serious as our able-bodied counterparts, and we'll train all year long leading up to these events, and then we'll really hone in our training for these events. And then when you're here, you know, it's a lot of downtime and a lot of sitting around, just like able-bodied players do too. And we just prepared as much as we can for every event possible, for every scenario. And we get our draws the night before, and we get our order of play the night before, and we get a good night's sleep. We eat right. We train right, and we get ready to play and prepare as much as possible for each day's matches. And you know, unlike our able-bodied counterparts, we don't get days off in between, so we just play straight through singles and doubles on most days. So we just rest up and stay prepared and train hard all year long and give it our best shot every time we step on the court.
And then, David, I would imagine for you, you know, training-wise and making sure that your body's right, is it a lot of arm strength? I mean, what are you guys using to really make sure? Obviously, you want your tennis strokes to be there, but you've got to move yourself around the court too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you know, the typical build for a able-bodied tennis player is quite lean and whatnot. And in wheelchair, you're a little thicker because you do have to have the strength to maneuver your chair. So strength and flexibility is huge in wheelchair tennis, you know. And again, depending on your level of disability. So for me, being paralyzed from the chest down, I don't have the ability to use my abs. So I have zero ab muscles. So just like my legs being paralyzed, my abs are paralyzed. So I can't work and strengthen my core. My core is what it is. And so, you know, I have a little bit of a pooch in my stomach because I don't have the ability to tighten it up and keep it in. So for me, it's strengthen what I do have, which is my shoulders, my triceps, my biceps, you know, and get those as strong and functional as possible. But in our men's division and some of our quad division players as well, the women, they can strengthen their core. You know, obviously having strong leg muscles isn't the most important in wheelchair tennis because you're not overly using your legs. So having strong hip flexors and strong abdominal muscles, back muscles, as well as arms, hands, and shoulders, you know, that makes a huge difference. And so, you know, it's just all based on what type of disability you have and what works and doesn't work. And as long as you can maximize what you have, that's the most important thing.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the game itself, but what do you want people to know or learn about wheelchair tennis? I mean, whether they're here at the U.S. Open and they're watching on court, or they're at home and they might catch it on a live stream, what would you want to tell them about the game of wheelchair tennis?
Oh, man, I think just get out there and look at it and watch it. And I think after a while, after half a game or so, you'll just be watching tennis and you'll almost forget the fact that they're in a chair, you know, that we're in chairs. And you'll just start to realize, wow, this guy's picking on this person's disability, and it's not a bad thing. It's a normal thing. You know, if I'm playing somebody who has a very weak backhand because their triceps are partially paralyzed, I'm going to pick on that. And it's a natural thing. If I'm an able-bodied player and I know I'm playing somebody who has a weaker backhand, I'm going to pick on their backhand, you know. And I think that's the biggest thing, is as you start watching it, you'll just realize that it's just tennis, you know, and you'll see that we're doing the same things as the able-bodied world is, and giving it our best effort out there. And, you know, occasionally we take a second bounce, and occasionally the ball hits our chair and we can't get out of the way of it. But if you come out and you watch it, I think you'll be impressed, and you'll be, you know, maybe you'll be inspired, maybe you won't, but there's no doubt in my mind you can't walk away from watching it and say that was impressive. You know, and that's maybe trying to sound not biased or anything, but it's just the truth. It's an awesome sport, and it so emulates the able-bodied game that you will then forget about the chair and you'll just see tennis for what it is. So,
all right, well, thanks so much, and best of luck.
Yeah, thank you very much, and go Hawks.
Very cool to hear from a Paralympian and a U.S. Open champion in David Wagner. And really, if you've never seen wheelchair tennis, get out there, whether you're here in New York or whether you can stream it online. It is incredible to watch. Lastly, we've got Jake Garner, who is one of the preeminent, he's a gold badge chair umpire. He's one of the best umps in the world. And I first asked him to tell us about his path to the chair.
Mine was, I guess, an interesting one, because I got into tennis officiating a little bit for the money. I live in Tallahassee, Florida, and there's two major universities there that were looking for officials to do their matches. And there was a flyer up at the club where I played tennis. And I was always interested in the rules of all the sports I played growing up. And so this seemed an interesting way to learn the rules a little bit better, as well as go out and work a couple of college matches on the weekend, earn a little extra money. And that was when I was still in high school. So I started doing some of those. We had a professional tournament that I called lines at. And I sort of fell into it at the right time. There was a push to find some newer officials. So I worked another pro event in Jacksonville. And that sort of gave me the stepping stone to come to the U.S. Open and work some more events. And I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the excitement of the job, the travel, and all of that. And, you know, that was, you know, 25 years ago or so.
Yeah, so now the world is nuanced, right? I mean, everyone's industry is nuanced, but for the officials, explain a little bit of, there's a lot of different tiers as far as the tracks that you can take. You said doing lines, which means you're a line umpire or calling lines. Maybe you've got the service line or you've got the baseline, but essentially you're climbing the ladder. And now at this point, you've reached what is the pinnacle. You are a gold badge umpire, right?
Yeah, that's right. There are different paths to take. Some use the path of being a line umpire to move on to becoming a chair umpire, but there's also a lot of really good line umpires that that's what their focus is. And the same thing, they move up the ladder of level of events, you know, calling, you know, local tournaments to calling challengers, which are the minor leagues of tennis, to moving up to being able to call, you know, the Grand Slams or the other professional events, you know, here in the U.S. So my path took me through using calling lines and being a line umpire as a step to becoming a chair umpire, because that was something that interested me, the challenge of it, the unknown of the day-to-day, you know, every match is different. You never know what's going to happen. So I used that to get my experience there, because you can't create that experience. You know, being on a court, even as a line umpire for intense matches, you learn something from that. You see how some of the other top chair umpires have handled situations, and you get a feel for what it's like to be out there. And that was how I used calling lines to be my step towards becoming a chair umpire.
So now you're telling me before we started, 5 U.S. Open men's singles finals. You've been a finalist 5 times. Congratulations. But tell me, I mean, you've done a lot of the other big tournaments, right? I mean, you're a familiar face on the tour. Just kind of describe, as far as your experience goes, maybe on the bigger stages that people would recognize. And then also what kind of your travel schedule entails, because I see a lot of the same faces on the sidelines, maybe at American tournaments. And then for the chair umpires, you've got people who work for the WTA, the ATP, the ITF. It kind of depends on what people choose to make their yearly travel schedule.
Yeah, that's right. And I work for the ITF and the Grand Slams. So most of my work is with those organizations. So my yearly schedule, like I said, it works with the Grand Slams. So I start the year in Australia, which is a great place to go at the beginning of the year. You get sort of away from the winter, although it's not that bad of a winter in Florida, but you know, it's a great place to start the year. And then the only, you know, then I know where I'm going for the French Open and Wimbledon and of course the US Open. Those dates are fixed, which is great for my calendar, because I know kind of when I'm working. And I know the weeks of Davis Cups and Fed Cups. So I always sort of know when I'm working. I may not always know where I'm going. So that is the bit, you know, the basic part of my calendar. And then it changes a little bit. Some tournaments, some Grand Slams I work qualifying and some I don't. So sometimes I'm, you know, in Melbourne for 3 weeks and Paris for 3 weeks and maybe only Wimbledon for 2 weeks. And so it's, you know, it's not always the same, but, you know, for the most part, I know that those are the tournaments I'm working and I'm usually there for at least 2 weeks.
So now let's skip into a tennis match itself, right? Say you're working a best of 5 men's match. What do you have to do to get ready? And I think for you guys, you rarely see the chair umpire leave the chair. And what are the things that you're focused on to make sure that you're doing your job correctly? Because you're not only the person that's sort of refereeing or overseeing the match itself, but you're also directing the line umpires, making sure everyone's in their places and that the players are as happy as they can be with the officiating and with the match itself.
Each chair umpire has their own kind of way to get ready for a match. Mine, I don't have anything specific I do. I just have some things I don't do, which is, you know, I guess what I do is I shut off. So I find, especially a really big match that there's a lot of anticipation for, I find a quiet place just to be by myself for a couple of minutes, you know, 15 or 20 minutes before I then go on court. So it depends a little bit on where we are, you know, exactly how I do that, you know, but at the tournaments I work all the time, I know where that place is. I know what I need to do and just get my thoughts on just, you know, and really it's more about clearing my head than it is actually getting my thoughts on the match ahead. It's just, you know, whatever else has been happening throughout the day is just gone. Focus on, you know, what I'm about to do. And then once you step on court is when, at least for me, my mind starts going and thinking about all of the things that I have to take care of, which, as you said, is everything on the court. You know, we're responsible for everything that happens on the court, more or less, once we step on court. And what we focus on differs from match to match, because the match requires some different things sometimes. Sometimes, you know, the players are being a little more, are questioning more calls, so we have to focus on that a little bit more. Sometimes there's outside issues, you know, weather's an issue, whatever it may be. So what exactly we're focusing on changes from match to match. It's not always, you know, it's not a script that we can follow. It'd be a lot easier if it was. It was, if it was do this and then do this and then do this. It's always changing, which is one of the things that makes the job so fun.
Yeah. One of my favorite things is when a line umpire makes a close call. Usually after the point, there's a very subtle eye contact, and the chair umpire will kind of nod and say, "Great job, you know, good call." What are the little things I think that makes everyone? Because this is your office, and I also think that it's interesting. I always get frustrated when they show the line umpire who's made a call and there's a challenge, a Hawkeye, because we all make mistakes. I make mistakes every day in my job. I know everyone who's listening to the podcast does too, but your guys' mistakes get so highlighted because of just the nature of the job too.
Well, if you're picking up on our subtle calls, then maybe we should be a little more subtle about them. But you know, when we as officials step out on court, we're there to, we all have the same end goal, which is to have the best officiating possible. Our roles are different, but you know, the role of the chair umpire is to bring on, you know, and keep the line umpires pumped up. And sometimes that's, you know, when they make a great call, letting them know, hey, you made a great call. And sometimes that's when they made a mistake, letting them know, hey, let's let that one go. You know, we trust you. You're out here because you deserve to be out here. Let's get the next one. And, you know, officials always get shown when they make a mistake, and that's just what we have, you know, we know is happening. You know, we don't get appreciated all the time when we do a great job, but that's not what we're out there for. We're not out there for the glory of it. We're out there to try to do the best that we can. And sometimes when we make a mistake, it's noticed, and sometimes when we do a good job, it goes unnoticed. But, you know, we'd all rather be unnoticed.
Yeah. Best part of the job. Why do you love your job so much?
I think for me, the best part is just the travel, you know, being in different places, experiencing tennis in different ways. You know, all four Grand Slams have a completely different atmosphere, a different feel to them. And it makes it, like I've said before, different every day I go to work. It's never the same thing. Even though the game is the same, it's never, you know, I've never had two matches that are exactly the same. Something's always a little bit different. And for me, to be able to travel and see the world while enjoying every day of my job and enjoying the challenge is by far the best thing.
In how many different languages can you say tennis scores?
A lot, right?
Yeah, I would say it's probably a lot, but unfortunately my foreign language skills are limited to just calling the score. I have no fluency in any other language. But yeah, it's, you know, that's part of our job is we have to be able to at least call the score in a lot of different languages when we travel out to different countries.
And do you, I would imagine that you walk out of the office, walk off court, and sometimes you feel great about how the day has gone and other times maybe not. How do you sort of self-evaluate? And I know that there's an evaluation system for you guys too, but, because what you're saying is so true, and I think it's tough for officials because you only a lot of times get noticed when things go wrong. But when things go smoothly, it's kind of like, okay, that actually feels good that nothing dramatic happened.
It's true, but like you said, the self-evaluation is so important. You've got to be able to recognize in yourself. More importantly, I think, when things go well, you know, because, you know, we get evaluated from off court sometimes and everybody picks up on some of the things that don't go well. And as officials, we're all helpful to try to get somebody through that situation and understand and make it better. But when you have a match where you do everything really well, you still need to be able to appreciate that and not just let it go as, okay, I did a good job and that's my job. But you need to be able to say, yep, I did well. This is why I did well and everything like that. So, you know, that's something that I've had to learn how to do. It's not easy, but to be able to step off and I'm, you know, I'm my own worst critic, but I've learned to become my own biggest fan as well. When I do well, I can appreciate that and I can take that. And I know what that feels like and that's a good feeling. And I know what being on the wrong end of that feels like. And it's an awful feeling. And, you know, we just try to not have it happen again. But for the same reason, you're going to have another match where maybe things don't go exactly the way you want to. But what you don't want is to make the same mistake again and again and again. You want to fix that one and maybe you make another one, but try not to let that one happen again.
Okay, I'm going to give you an option to not answer this question, but favorite match or most memorable match that you've got to do in your career? Because as I mentioned, you've done five men's singles finals just here at the US Open. You've obviously done a lot of other high profile and, you know, very important tennis matches.
I'm not sure I'm going to not answer it, but I'm not sure that I can answer it because they all have different, you know, feelings, good feelings for different reasons. I think, you know, the ones I remember the most are I was on the match at the Australian Open a few years ago, more than a few years ago now, that went really late or early in the morning. We finished at like 4:30 in the morning. And I remember that happening, you know, and just the uniqueness of that situation. So that sticks out. But there's countless other matches where the tennis has been unbelievable from the first point. And you just come off and you know that the players gave everything they've got and they're playing at the highest level. And then that helps if as the umpire, you have a good match as well, you know, to be able to know that everything worked out well that match. But there's so many for different reasons, you know, and they just stick out. You know, sometimes it's the play, sometimes it's the atmosphere, especially when you get to talking about Davis Cups or Fed Cups. You know, you're in a situation where you've got 20,000 fans, most of them cheering for one side. You know, not, you know, it creates such an atmosphere that you remember it even if the match itself isn't the best match.
Well, I don't think people are jealous of the pressure, but I think they're jealous of the seat that you get in the house. Jay Garner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A big thanks to Martin Blackman, to David Wagner, and to Jake Garner for giving us some insight there on different aspects that go on around the U.S. Open as we close out the tournament. Once again, thanks for listening to Inside the U.S. Open. You can find us on Audioboom. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts. And we'll be back with one more episode to close out what's been an incredible 2017 U.S. Open.